Once more under the bridge, dear friends. Let's fill up the wall with our English dead. And here we are, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, with another exciting episode of The Personal Wealth Coach starring Jeff McClure. Jake is out of town this week. So do you get just me again this week? Life can be hard that way. Today, if today is November 24th, where you are, of the year 2018, you're welcome to call in and give us a call. You're welcome to call in and give us a call. That's a good combination, calling in and giving us a call. At 773-1400, of course, the area code is 254 here in Temple, Killeen, this area. So 254-773-1400 if you'd like to talk about anything or make comments or anything to do with investments, the economy, economics, or things of that ilk. And I'm also obliged to tell you that the Personal Wealth Coach is not only the name of this radio program, it's also the name of a registered investment advisory firm in Salado that does business all over the country and to U.S. citizens outside, and with U.S. citizens outside the United States. And that we're not, but I'm not providing investment advice on this program. I'm providing what is known as education. Specific investment advice is rendered to individuals based on their specific circumstances and specific goals, and so it should be different for each person. The information that we present on here, or I present on here today, since it's only me, is information we have obtained from what we believe to be reliable sources, things like the Wall Street Journal and Barron's and Financial Times and things of that nature, or the United States government for that matter. And but we don't make any warranty or guarantee as to the accuracy or completeness of that information. And speaking of telephone calls, on 773-1400, we have a caller. So, caller, you're on the air with Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead.
Yes, sir. Enjoy the show. There was an article in the Wall Street about Rockwell Collins, who is an avionics company, is being acquired by United Technologies. Mm-hmm. And the article said that the Chinese just signed off on the deal. And I was curious, why would a Chinese company have to bless a U.S. acquisition? I'll hang up and listen. Thank you.
Well, it's a good question. And when I read the article, I asked the same question. But the point is that both those companies have significant subsidiaries. That's a mouthful to say. They have significant subsidiaries operating inside China, and if they're going to merge in the United States, they are also going to merge in China, and the regulators in China had to sign off on it in order for the deal to go through, and they did. In the objective there, just like the objective here, is to avoid getting monopolies and to make sure that it's not something that's going to take over and adjust prices. And basically, it's not so much that there, it's just the fact that they did have to sign off on it, and they did, which, by the way, is a good sign. If the Chinese were being interested in to strike back against the United States for the tariffs and they were being particularly hostile, all they would have to say is no. And it would stop the deal in the United States and would ultimately hurt a little bit, hurt our economy and hurt those two companies, and would be a strike. It would be seen as a strike at the United States. Instead, they chose, the Chinese government chose to be cooperative, which is a good sign. It is an indication that maybe the trade war that is starting to heat up between the United States and China may not escalate out of control, which is one of the things, by the way, that is greatly affects the markets at this point, and one of the reasons we're in a correction right now in the stock market. Okay, moving on. Let's talk about the markets for just a second. This was they called it a foreshortened week, which I like. It's in a foreshortened. I had to look up to see why. What's the difference between a shortened week and a foreshortened week? And a foreshortened week is one that's planned to be short, and one that you knew in advance was going to be short, whereas apparently a shortened week is one you didn't know advance was going to be short, so foreshortened is the right word. But the stock market, the S&P 500, was down 3.58%, closed out at 26.32. Around 29.30, actually 29.29, I remember very well, It pretty much was its peak back in September. And this close of 2632.56 means it's down 10.13% from its closing high in late September. Year-to-date, it's down 1.54%, and 1 year ago, compared with 1 year ago, it's only up 1.37%, which is a negligible gain at all. So that's we're solidly in the second correction. It's what's called a confirming correction of the year. There is an old saying on Wall Street, though. The bears have Thanksgiving, but the bulls have Christmas. And it's one of those things that doesn't pan out every year, and it doesn't pan out in every situation, but it's not at all unusual in a normal cyclical market situation, which we've not been in for some time. But in a normal cyclical market situation, it's not unusual to see a correction that first sort of shows its head a little bit in October and then is really apparent in its latter expression over Thanksgiving. Thanksgiving week is not an unusual correction week in the market. And if we follow through on that tradition that we're back in, in essence, the tradition is that we've somehow come back into normalcy of a sort, then what we will see is a rally in, going forward between now and the end of the year. Now, it'll be an interesting thing to watch. There's obviously some short-term effects there that everybody seems to be concerned about. The one wild card in the midst of this is the tariffs. If the president goes ahead with the 25% tariffs on everything imported from China, no, there probably won't be a rally. Matter of fact, we could see further declines in the market. Not because of anything esoteric, it's simply because a lot of the retailers and a lot of the companies that make things across the country import a lot of things from China, and it takes years to change that supply chain around. And if you were to increase the price of what they use to make things with by 25%, or you increase the price of goods and goods that are sold in the big box stores from Walmart to Target to JCPenney to whatever, by 25%, you're going to see a hit. And that type of hit would probably have a negative effect on the market, although a lot of it's already priced in. So going forward, there's a pretty fair chance we'll see a rally towards the end of the year, unless the 25% tariffs get imposed. Now, if 25% tariffs get imposed, all bets are off. That's kind of, like I said, that's a wild card. That's a pretty extreme position to take and will definitely have a negative impact on the economy. Since the president is not interested, by all accounts, in having a negative impact on the U.S. economy, I don't think it's going to happen, but it's always possible. So the 10-year U.S. Treasury note actually slid a little bit, down about relative 14%. It was up to 3.09 at the beginning of the week. It ended the week at 3.048. That's still 32% higher than it was a year ago when it was about 2.3, which means interest rates are up, which is a big contributor to the fact that housing starts have slowed even further. Existing home sales were up a little bit, but not as much as was expected. And across the board, housing as a stimulant in the economy is a negative number. It's one of the few things that are truly negative out there. It's important to look at the big picture. And this week we had the Conference Board's Index of Leading Economic Indicators. It was up 0.1, and it's not a percentage. It's actually an index. But for the last 2 months, last month it was up 0.5, and the month before that it was up 0.6, but it's still positive. And a positive number is a strong indication, and we say strong indication, there's not any exceptions to this, but there could always be one. It's a strong indication that we have at least 6 months and more likely a year ahead with no recession on the horizon. The leading economic indicators, the Conference Board's leading economic indicators, have been around for quite a number of decades now, and they do a wonderful job of forecasting good times. There have been several occasions when the economic indicators have forecast a recession that just didn't happen. It almost happened, but it didn't happen. But we've never, since they've been in effect, which is back in the 1960s when they first came out, we've never had a recession in the United States that wasn't forecast by two or three consecutive months of declines in the leading economic indicators. Now, we're right on the edge. 0.1 is pretty close to zero, which is pretty close to a negative number. And since it was up 0.6 2 months ago, that indicates the growth speed, the acceleration in the economy, the growth in the economy is slowing down. Doesn't mean the economy is slowing down. Just mean the growth in the economy is showing signs of slowing down. Interestingly enough, if you're an economic geek like I am, is noting that the coincident economic indicators, that's the ones that don't forecast the future but tell us where we are right now, we're up 0.2. And this is the big one, the lagging economic indicators, which are indicators that something has happened in the past that is creating a good economy today, is up 0.4. So when you have that slope where the lagging economic indicators are up significantly and the leading economic indicators aren't, that's certainly not a red flag, but it is a yellow flag. That, along with a lot of other data, strongly suggests that the economy is running on momentum right now, and it is running pretty much at full tilt. It's the growth in the economy is going to be slowing. Again, that doesn't mean the economy is slowing down. It doesn't mean we're in a recession. It just means the rate of growth is slowing for a very good reason. We're running up against some big constraints in infrastructure. And if you wonder what a constraint in infrastructure looks like, get on I-35 from here and try to drive to Austin during a normal business day, and you will discover what a constraint on infrastructure looks like. Not counting the traffic, not counting the construction and the slowdowns that are associated with the construction, the highway itself is operating pretty much during the business day is operating at capacity. And even with 130, the toll road, allowing a bypass, so a lot of the traffic goes around at 130 when it first was opened. I don't know if any of you drove that route. Was pretty much a vacant highway. You could just drive it by yourself if you're willing to pay the tolls. And I went to and from the airport a couple of times recently and noted that 130, we couldn't maintain speed limit either coming or going because there was too much traffic on 130. And Google Maps had directed me around downtown Austin, around the I-35 route, because it was even slower. And what that means, in effect, is that commerce restraints are in place. So if we manufacture more stuff, or we want to sell more stuff that's manufactured in Mexico, or we want to ship stuff to Mexico to be manufactured, parts to Mexico to have it manufactured in Mexico, which is a big piece of the U.S. economy. We have hit a constraint in I-35 that says we couldn't, for example, to give you an example of what that means in gross terms, we could not increase our capacity, we couldn't increase our economic output by 20% because that would put 20% more trucks on the highway. And that takes you to another constraint that we're looking at. We're out of truck drivers. We are just flat out of truck drivers. There's not enough drivers to drive the trucks, and we're out of trucks in many areas. We can manufacture more trucks fairly easily. What's hard to do is get trained drivers to drive those trucks. It's a stressful job. No matter how much you pay, if there's not people who have the proper licensing and experience, you're not going to be able to fix that situation. And that's another constraint that's on society. So when we talk about infrastructure constraints limiting the growth of our economic system, we mean that. And we don't measure, hey, we're doing as well as we did last year, so that's really good. The way we look at the dynamic of our economy is if it's not growing, it's about to shrink. And that is a truth. That's one of those absolute truths that is unpleasant, but it's very real. You're either growing or you're shrinking. And we're hitting the limits on growth. The expectations up till now, from 2009 to the present, a lot of the growth in our economy, a lot of the growth in the stock market, a lot of the growth across the board has been because we expected better times ahead. And so when we expect better times ahead, if you're in business, for example, you're willing to invest, in many cases, in buying new equipment to produce, to be more productive, to produce more things, to offer better services, and because there's the expectation that there is a gap there. There's a gap where the demand is higher than the supply, and you're capable of filling it. So businesses invest money, which puts more people to work in the manufacturing sector and puts more people to work across the board. And that's the way we have been running along now for about 11, almost 12 years. I mean, almost 10 years, I'm sorry. Almost 10 years, almost 11 years, which is pretty much, it isn't a record expansion, but it's pretty close to it. Why do we economists say that now's the time to be cautious? Well, we say now's the time to be cautious because we see us hitting constraints in society and in our infrastructure that we simply can't overcome easily. And because we can't overcome them, that means we're going to hit a point where there's bottlenecks where people continue to produce, which means at some point manufacturers will overproduce, they'll be overhiring, and things will suddenly reverse, which is the way they tend to do things. Now, that's called a cyclical, it's called an economic cycle, and it's called a cyclical economy. We haven't had one of those in a long time. And that's weird. As a matter of fact, since 2000, so for now 18 years, we have been running pretty much outside of the normal cyclical economics environment that through the most of history, our economy has been lockstep in that environment. And the reason that we're outside of that is we've had what's called a secular bear or a secular negativity in the market. That's the baseline I want to talk about today is economic cycles. They're very real. They're very understandable. They have enough variance in them that you can't predict them exactly, but you can say with a great deal of probability, this is where we are in the cycle. Here's what's going on, and here's what we're likely to see. It's just like seasons here in Central Texas. You can predict that in the summertime it's going to be hot, in the wintertime it's going to be cold. You can't predict how cold it's going to get. Some winters here we have a lot of freezes, we have snow, we have a winter that everyone agrees is an exceptionally difficult winter. And some years here in Texas, in my memory, we've had 100-plus degree temperatures in January. And we just basically didn't have a winter that winter. It just never froze. It was, we had big fires on Fort Hood last time we had that because the system was simply not set up in the middle of winter. The vegetation and so on simply wasn't prepared for 100 degree temperatures and the drying effect of those 100 degree temperatures, and the rest of us weren't either. So just like seasonality occurs, but it can be interrupted before it reasserts itself, so the cyclical markets and economy occur. They can be interrupted, and they are interrupted by sometimes larger cycles. And there's several cycles that are very, very well documented. And the longer ones have bigger effects when they hit, and they bury the shorter ones, but the shorter ones are always there ready to come back when things return to normal. And we are returning to normal in our socioeconomic system. And as we return to normal, we would expect to see a recession around 2020. Why? Well, that's just when all the indicators point towards a recession. Well, why have we gone for such a long time without a recession? And the answer is because the Federal Reserve pumped a huge amount of stimulus into the economy. They pumped a lot of money into the economy to get us out of the Great Recession, which easily could have been a depression. Ben Bernanke was probably the leading expert in the world on the mistakes, the economic mistakes the Federal Reserve made that created the Great Depression out of what would otherwise have been a normal cyclical recession. And he went exactly in the opposite direction. And as a result, the United States is an economy that is preeminent in the world. The rest of the world was hesitant to take the bold steps that he took with quantitative easing. And the Europeans were very slow to do that because they're far more afraid of inflation, and they weren't going to pay a lot of attention to history like he did. And the end result is their recovery was much more shallow, and it was much later coming. As a matter of fact, quantitative easing is still in place in Europe. They're still stimulating the economy, and they're supposed to come out of it next year, which is ironic because all of the indicators point right now towards a recession in or around 2020, so they'll just have eased out of quantitative easing when they fall back into recession, which is not going to be a pretty picture in Europe, and you ought to be kind of glad you're not there and you are here. Speaking of that, the economic cycle, it runs in about 10-year increments normally, and I say that from the 19th century through the last half of the 19th century with some notable exceptions, there was what we would call a depression or severe recession every 10 years, and it happened like clockwork. In 0 years, you had recessions. And that cycle persists into the 21st century. It was very clear in the 19th century, and in much of the 20th century, it was clear. The exceptions are when something really, really major occurred, like World War II or the Great Depression, that damped down those cycles. And we are no longer in a World War II or Great Recession or Great Depression situation. We're through that. The Federal Reserve, as a matter of fact, is busy normalizing interest rates. When we talk about them raising interest rates, which they almost certainly will do again in December, the reason they're raising interest rates is to get them back to neutral. Right now, we still have a slightly stimulative interest rate situation. Inflation is running along at about 2.5%, and the Federal Reserve's short-term loans to banks are running at 2 to 2.25, which means that inflation is running higher than the Federal Reserve is charging to borrow money, which means you can borrow money from the Federal Reserve, and in effect, the Federal Reserve is subsidizing your borrowing. You actually make money on the borrowing of money from the Federal Reserve, which is what stimulation is all about. When interest rates get up around 3% from their 2 to 2.25 that we're seeing right now, which should occur about the middle of next year, then you start to see those interest rates begin to put the brakes on in the economy. They begin to slightly apply the brakes to an overheated economy. Now, why is that important? In order to avoid the boom and bust cycle that we saw in the 19th century and into the 20th century that ultimately the accumulation of those cycles, they got worse with each 10-year cycle. And ultimately, in 1930, we had one that was so severe that it rolled over partially due to policy mistakes, partially due to some action by Congress and the president. It actually rolled over into the Great Depression. And the Great Depression, in turn, generated World War II. And the consensus among scholars and among those who study this in any form is that we'd rather not do that again. And we've done a pretty admirable job of heading that off in the past. And so the Federal Reserve's job at this point is, as the economy heats up and inflation runs above 2%, their business is to raise interest rates slowly to slow down the peak in the economy, dampen it out, and in dampening out the peak, They also leave themselves room to lower interest rates and use qualitative easing if they need to, stimulus, to shallow out the bottom of the next recession, because there will be a next recession. Business cycles are real. Economic cycles are real. They have occurred in, as a matter of fact, they occur in any dynamic, large-scale dynamic system, whether it's the economy or machinery. Even steam engines and the lawnmower engine has a governor on it that keeps it from running too fast, or and hopefully it'll run by itself to keep from running too slow. But the governor increases the fuel going in if the engine slows down, and decreases the fuel going to the engine if the engine gets to going too fast. And it's an automatic device. And the Federal Reserve's job is to act in that automatic way to try to keep things from getting out of control. There's an old saw, in effect, that says the Federal Reserve's job is to take away the punch bowl just when the party gets going good, and that's certainly true. But it is 33 minutes after the hour, and we probably need to run commercials to keep Town Square Media and KTEM management happy. So you're welcome. This is the Personal Wealth Coach. You're welcome to give us a call in here at 254-773-1400 if you have anything, any comments or thoughts about what we're talking about, or anything else to do with investing or economics. And we'll be back on the other side with more of the Personal Wealth. And we're back, or at least I'm back, with more of the Personal Wealth Coach with Jeff McClure. Jake is out of town this week. And if today is November 24th, 2018, where you are, you're welcome to give me a call in here at 254-773-1400 and talk about anything to do with economics or investing. We started talking about in the first half of this hour about the economic cycles and market cycles that go on, and we're re-entering the normal, it appears at least, we're entering the normal cyclical market environment and the cyclical economic environment that through the majority of history the United States has seen and the world has seen and any other dynamic system sees. There are some very large issues that conflict with that environment from time to time, and we've just come through two downturns, and it seems like, okay, we had one in 2008 and 9. What was the other one? Well, it was 2000 through 2002. So major bear markets and major economic downturns have two prongs. The one that occurred in the 1930s, that at least out from the history book many of you are familiar with, the first downturn started in 1929, the stock market crashed, and shortly thereafter the economy started down. It bottomed out in 1934, came back. And there was a second one that occurred, though, in 1937. And if you go back through history and you look at these major downturns in the United States economy and, not coincidentally, the market, you can see that they almost always come in two prongs. And we've been through the two prongs. And, yes, it's taken us 18 years to get through the two, 18, almost 19 years now to get through the two prongs. But we're through them. We've cleaned out a lot of the garbage in the system. We've restructured a lot of things, and we're transitioning, frankly, right now from a recovery to an expansion. Now, it doesn't seem that way. There's all the pessimism that is going around and people predicting the end of the world momentarily, but it's not true. What's true is during a recovery, growth stocks tend to do relatively well. Now, growth stocks are those companies whose stock price is valued on anticipated future earnings. And they tend to, you look at their price-to-earnings ratio and or P.E. ratio, and you discover that it's generally pretty high and on the face of it pretty absurd at current earnings levels. But the reason people buy these companies and they buy their stock is they expect to see the earnings go up very fast in the future, and therefore it seems reasonable to them to buy it. Actually, they don't think that way. It just works out. They actually buy it because they expect the stock price to be higher in the future, and they can sell it to a greater fool. But at some point, the recovery ends. the recovery takes us to the point where we're back to some form of normalcy. And the gaps that were left wide open, the opportunities that were left wide open during the previous recession or the bear market that we saw, are pretty much filled. And now it comes, it's what's called a stock picker's environment. By the way, historically, indexes have done better than the average individually managed or professionally managed fund during recoveries. But once the recovery is over, that reverses to where the need is to go out and find companies that the market has overlooked, that are undervalued, and you buy them and you hang on to them for a while. It's the kind of thing that Warren Buffett specializes in, is finding these companies that are worth more than the stock market thinks they're worth, and buying them and then being patient and waiting for them to come up. And we're back in that mode. Right now we're seeing a rotation going on in the market, where a lot of the high growth stocks, the tech stocks, were sold. Those are the ones that are down the most. It's not unusual to see among the large, well-known tech stocks to see them down 20% at this point, which would put them in bear market territory. And at the same time, we've actually seen increases in some of the value stocks. These are stocks that were trading at very low price-earnings ratios, and they were simply out of favor, and they weren't growing really fast, but the money is starting to flow back into it. Is it run back into it enough to graze the whole market? No. And it generally takes a while for this rotation to occur. But it'll be interesting to see if this works out. If it does, then what we'll see is a classical turnover in the market that occurs late in an economic and market cycle. It indicates that the bull market has shifted gears and is going to go into the second phase of the bull market, which is when the value stocks get priced up to fair value. And by the way, from that point, people run out of bargains to buy, and they just start buying at random, and that's generally marks the beginning of the end for a bull market. But we're not there yet. Why do I think this is true? Why do I think we're not in a bear market? Why do I think the world is not coming to an end? Because there's so much pessimism. I've been around long enough to validate what the history books and textbooks say about market valuations. There's two ways of looking at market valuation. One of them is to look at the price-earnings ratio. The forward price-earnings ratio of the Standard & Poor's 500 stock index has averaged about 17.5 over a long time. In other words, the price of the average stock in the S&P 500 is about 17.5 times the anticipated earnings in the following year. For whatever it's worth, that's roughly, and I mean very roughly, a 5% yield on the stock. When the price earnings ratio gets up to 20, that would be exactly a 5% yield. Except for the fact that we expect that the stock prices and earnings will continue to go up over the years. Therefore, that makes it a little more complex to figure in stocks. But the point is, what we're seeing is this rotation over to value, which is healthy. And we see that the forward price earnings ratio is now about 15, which is unusually low, instead of being 17 to 17.5, which indicates that there's the stock market itself at this point, based on its forward price-earnings ratio, is a little low. When we look at the long-term trend of the market after subtracting out inflation, which is one of the things we do at the Personal Wealth Coach, we see that the S&P 500 is slightly below its long-term growth trend. And by the way, if you discount inflation, on average, over a long period of time, the S&P 500 grows at about 7.5% a year. Now, you throw in inflation over the last 70 to 100 years, and the growth rate rises up to about 10.5 or 11, on average. That doesn't mean it's going to do it every year, and in some years it's going to go up, some years it's going to go down. But the average is what we look at, and if it's below the trend line, and it is slightly below the trend line right now, that means it's not overpriced. And inevitably, throughout the history that I've looked at, and I've got a lot of data on the last 40 years of the market, when it gets above trend line, it can continue to run above trend line for some time, but eventually it's going to revert way back down to the trend line and eventually drop below it. But we're not above the trend line. We've been below the trend line for some time. We're back up on the trend line. The market is not overvalued. The market is roughly on the trend line. What does that mean? That means that you're not going to probably have outsized gains in the immediate future. But the chances of getting a major stock market crash at this point, historically, based on historical data, are slim to none. Now, that doesn't mean that some great disaster couldn't occur. It doesn't mean that the president, if he were to impose 25% tariffs on everything that was imported from China, which he's threatened to do, couldn't create a pretty good market downturn simply because, but it would be temporary. It would only be temporary and the market would recover. 1987 is an example of the market getting ahead of itself in a very short period of time and then coming back down to reality very suddenly. A lot of you don't remember 1987, but we had basically about a 30% drop in the market in about a day, which was really quite impressive at the time and scary as all get out. But when it corrected, it simply corrected back to its long-term trend line. And then from there, it gradually pulled itself back up out of it. And as long as you didn't buy during the insanity and then sell when it reintroduced itself to reality, you're actually in pretty good shape going forward. And so this is the environment that we're in today. It's nothing unusual. It's pretty standard, which is why, barring the imposition of the 25% tariffs, again, that is the wild card right now, the market probably will rally into the end of the year. No guarantees here, folks. This is not investment advice, and I'm not telling you to buy into the market. It's just to say the world is not coming to an end. And a big deal, a very big issue, in knowing where you are in the stock market cycles is to simply pick up the Wall Street Journal or go to a website, Yahoo Finance, or wherever you want to go, and read the headlines. And if the headlines indicate that doom and gloom is the order of the day, the worry factor is very, very high, we're still in a bull market. Now, that sounds kind of strange. All this negativity means we're in a bull market? Absolutely. That means that there's all that negativity strongly indicates there's a lot of people who want to read negative things. And who wants to read a negative thing about the market right now? Anybody who's not invested. Because it confirms that they're right, that they shouldn't be invested. When you need to be concerned in a stock market situation is when you pick up the Wall Street Journal or you go to the websites of the various financial reporting agencies and media out there, and you discover that there's not a single negative thing that anybody has to say. And there's some key signals when you begin to see people say things like, this could go on forever, it's different this time, the Fed or the federal government has somehow managed to master the economic cycle, and the economic cycle has gone away. That is the surefire indication that that you need to be afraid, and you need to build up your dry powder and your cash, and be quite concerned about what's going on in the market. It's when everybody else is crazy about buying, and nobody is worried that a market collapse is coming. Why? Because if everybody consistently is optimistic about the future and say we have nothing but good times ahead, then all the people that are going to buy have bought. And when all the buyers have done all the buying they're going to do, all that's left is selling. And the sellers just haven't pulled the trigger yet. But once they start selling, it tends to create an avalanche as they pile in on each other and continue to sell. And at some point, then, in a market downturn, you have the other end of the cycle, which is called capitulation, which is when the very optimistic people who all bought at the top of the market sell altogether pretty much at the same time towards the tail end of the market, and you get a smash downward as we did in the spring of 2009. Where everybody panics out of the market, and there's your indication at that point that that's the market bottom. That's called capitulation. And from there forward, you get a bull market. And that's, by the way, at the point of maximum pessimism. So at the point of maximum optimism is when we're about to have a bear market. And at the point of maximum pessimism is when you're at the bottom in a downturn. And if you're like me and you read the Wall Street Journal, read it online, you read it carefully, and if you read the Financial Times and you read any financial reporting agency or any financial reporting medium out there, you will see that the pessimism is so thick you could cut it with a knife. This is an indication of a market bottom. This is an indication that there's a lot of bull market ahead of us. And frankly, the president does have the ability to generate a big rise in the market at any time, simply saying, when he's at the G20 conference, I talked to President Xi and we're not doing the 25% tariffs. We're just simply not going to do it. The market would, in my opinion, would zoom upward dramatically, and good times would be back with us, and we'd be well on track to have a second leg to this bull market. So that's kind of in a nutshell, example of how market cycles work and what you should look for and what you shouldn't look for. Now, does timing the market work? Can you jump in and out of the market based on these cycles? No. It seems like you ought to be able to. It seems like, for instance, Jake and I have very successfully, we have lots of records on this, called every market bottom since the bottom in 1987. Every time the market turns down, it hits a bottom. We have certain indicators among them, and I don't know that we have any in our clientele right now, but for many years we had what we called little old ladies in tennis shoes. We had some very consistent clients. In some cases, they were little old ladies who would call in and want to jump out of the market the day it bottomed. We certainly did in 2009. And the other side of that is, I remember the top of the market in August of 1987 when my mother-in-law, who was in her 80s at the time, late 70s or early 80s, called from her quilting guild and asked, she said, I want to buy some shares in that Telefonos de Mexico, that Mexican telephone company, because I hear it's going to go up. And when a late 70s, early 80s little old lady calls from her quilting guild with a hot stock tip, that is generally an indication that it's over. And I remember the same thing occurring in 2000, only I was sitting in a restaurant in Fredericksburg, and I heard a ranching family next to us who were comparing stocks to livestock and cattle breeding, and concluded that every time that Dell splits, it goes up. So the young man who was being very loud and vocal at the table next to me was saying, I'm going to get me some of that Dell stock because every time it splits, it goes up. It's just like a cow having a calf. It's worth more money after she has the calf. And I looked at my wife at that point and I said, it's over. I'm not sure how far we're going to fall, but the bull market's over, because the last buyer is sitting at the table next to me who doesn't know the difference between livestock and common stock, and that buyer is about to go into the market and make a purchase, and that means all that's going to be left are sellers. And that was at the beginning of 2000, and of course what we saw from there forward was during 2000 we saw the downturn, and it lasted all the way to 2002 and a 50% drop in the stock market. So this is how you can tell where you are in market cycles, which leads me to be cognitively optimistic at this point, even though emotionally I'm affected just like anybody else is by all the negativity I read and all the nasty things I read and all the horrible things that are going to happen and all the headlines. They really don't amount to a hill of beans in the big picture, though. Speaking of big picture, I bet we have some more commercials we have to run, don't we, Aaron? We do. Okay. So you are listening to the Personal Wealth Coach. The number in here remains 254-773-1400, and we need to run some commercials, and we'll be back on the other side.
They get our kids to school safely.
Okay, so walk me through how you got to this answer.
They provide critical support in the classroom.
Chicken sandwich, my favorite.
They keep students nourished, so they're ready to learn.
I'm an outie.
They are there when accidents happen.
Oh, you're going to need a Band-Aid.
And they keep our schools beautiful.
School bus drivers, custodians, nurses, paraeducators, just a few of the education support professionals who help schools in Texas run smoothly every day. This is Noel Candelaria, president of the Texas State Teachers Association. They ensure that our students have a safe ride to school, healthy meals, and a clean environment to learn. So take a moment to say thank you to the ESPs in your school.
A message from the Texas State Teachers Association.
You're not wired to have a response to this sound. You're neutral to it. You hear it every time you finish a meal and never feel anything. But if we were able to associate this sound with a new stimulus, save the food, we've achieved pulling a natural response from you. Save the food. Why are we doing this, you may ask? Save the food. Because this ad is trying to change your after-meal behavior through brainwashing. Because food waste costs the average family $1,500 a year. Save the food. Cha-ching. And $1,500 extra is like getting a pay raise. Save the food. Cha-ching.
You're promoted.
Which could pay for your child's braces. Save the food. Cha-ching.
You're promoted.
Check out my braces.
So when you hear this sound, rethink your behavior. Cook it, store it, share it. Just don't waste it. For tips and recipes, visit SaveTheFood.com. Brought to you by NRDC and the Ad Council.
And we're back with more of the Personal Wealth Coach with Jeff McClure. Jake's out of town this week. Telephone number in here remains 254-773-1400 if you'd like to talk about anything to do with economics or investments or the market or anything of that ilk. We got about 4.5 minutes left in this first hour of the Personal Wealth Coach today, November 24th, in the foreshortened, I love that term, foreshortened Thanksgiving week, during which the stock market declined rather healthily and is now slightly below its long-term trend line and is developed into a very healthy low price-to-earnings ratio situation. To give me an example of what I mean by a low price-to-earnings ratio situation, as the market declined in 2000 through 2002, the price-to-earnings ratio kept going up because earnings were falling faster than the market was. At one point, when the market started to decline, the forward price-to-earnings ratio was 30. And again, it's about 15 right now, and it was 30 in 2000 when it started down. And as it continued down by 2001, and this is one of the great ironies, despite the fact that the market had fallen pretty healthily through into 2000 and on going into 2001, 1 or 2 months into 2001, the price-to-earnings ratio of the S&P 500 hit 45, which is absurd when you consider that the long-term average is 15, or it's actually 17.5. And it was at 45, which meant that people were reluctantly selling at that point. And after that, the selling really piled on, and eventually it fell 50% and came back, oddly enough, at the bottom in 2002. It was back to a normal price-to-earnings ratio. Now, how could you have avoided that in the 2000, in the run-up in the late 1990s? Is you would have been in value stocks rather than growth stocks, because all the run-up was in growth stocks, whereas value stocks that are priced, see, and there's a difference between value stocks and growth stocks, and these are asset classes. Growth stocks are based on expected future earnings 5 years from now, 3 years from now, 10 years from now. Value stocks are based, they're called balance sheet. It's called balance sheet investing. You look at the underlying value of the company, the underlying value that's on their balance sheet. You look at the breakup value of the company. This is what Warren Buffett is really good at. You look at if I were actually going to go buy that whole company myself, what would I pay for it? What would be a reasonable price to pay for that company so that I could get a reasonable return on my money based on its profitability, based on what it owns, just based on having it, just like you would with a piece of real estate. And if you determine that the stock is the total value of the stock on the open market of a company is below its intrinsic value, below what you'd pay for it if you would buy the whole company, then that obviously is a bargain and it's a good thing to buy. Does it mean that you'll make a profit right away? No, because undervalued companies can stay undervalued for quite a while before the value goes up and you have the opportunity to sell them. But over long periods of time, study after study after study have all agreed. Buying value stocks, if you're a long-term investor, yields a much greater return than buying growth stocks. because growth stocks may shoot up temporarily, but when they come down like a rocket ship. And it looks like we're coming up on the one-minute point before we have to be out of here. You are listening to the Personal Wealth Coach, and my name is Jeff McClure. The Personal Wealth Coach is also an SEC-registered investment advisory firm in Salado, Texas, and we give investment advice and management and assistance to people with, generally speaking, about $1 million or more invested net worth. And we provide pretty high-quality service, and you can reach us either to comment on the show or to whatever you need to do at 254-947-1111. Or if you would like to use an 800 number, you're certainly welcome to call 800-914-7526. That's 800-914-PLAN. Or you can email me at jeff@tpwc.com, or you can email Jake at jake@tpwc.com. And so until next hour, this has been the Personal Wealth Coach.